Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd, sitting in for Sean Corcoran. It's our weekly news roundup where we discuss some of the top stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in Woods Hole is Sean Gonsalves, a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Woods, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Joshua Balling will join us from the newsroom at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. And we'll hear from Nelson Siegelman, editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. What they say about March, in like a lion, out like a lamb.
That's right.
Not so much. Blizzard we had just a few days ago. Well, now it's pretty nice out.
It's pretty nice out. And, you know, this last storm, we actually got fairly lucky. I mean,
yes.
in the sense that the storm didn't come directly over us. So I guess, except for a woman out in Chatham whose home was being renovated. Fortunately, she wasn't in it.
Yeah.
That collapsed. Some trees came down and power outages for a few hours. And there were a couple of car accidents with minor injuries. But really, all in all, taken all together, I think this storm harmed us more psychologically than anything.
Yeah, because it's been, I mean, we've had, it seems like every Wednesday, just about, we've had some snow through this winter. Everybody is ready for spring. We're so ready. And so having a blizzard here at the end of March, yeah, you're right, it's our psyches that are damaged.
Right. Well, you know, one thing I thought that was interesting this week is we learned a new word this week, a new vocabulary word.
What was that?
Bombogenesis. And, you know, if folks that want to get into the weather phenomenon that is, it's this weather phenomenon that's characterized as like explosive intensification. So all of a sudden things get crazy. And that's what we saw here. I mean, we had high wind gusts.
That's for sure. I think 80-something miles an hour in Nantucket.
Yeah. Exactly. And then, as a matter of fact, this storm, even though it was a blizzard, it did attract, I don't know if you saw the little vignette that we had, but it did attract a hurricane storm. A hurricane storm tracker.
Yeah, I saw
came,
that. Yeah,
and he was here with his equipment measuring.
He should have gone
speeds.
To Nantucket.
Yeah. I heard that they got it much worse than we did.
Yeah, we'll check in with Josh later and find out what happened in Nantucket. This has been a tough winter though for the town's snow and ice budgets.
Big time. I mean, well, it's been one of the worst winters, you know, on record in terms of the, you know, first of all, the amount of snowfall. But I think what's made it even more difficult is the number of times. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I remember back in 2005, you know, which I think is still the record of the most snowfall. But with that, it was much more compact. You know, we got a lot of snow in just sort of a few storms. With this, like you said, it seems like every Wednesday, mm-hmm. here comes more snow, even as we're sitting here in spring. And so that's causing these towns to have to go way over budget. In Barnstable, their budget, snow and ice budget, was $600,000. They've spent about $2.3 million
wow.
so far.
That's amazing.
It's crazy. In Sandwich, you know, they're about $175,000. And for them, town officials there were sort of, the question there was sort of, you know, to plow or not to plow all of the roads. They were trying to figure out, you know, how to move forward with that. It's always, I guess, sort of dicey because on the one hand, you know, public safety is people's main concern and you can't leave roads
right.
unplowed. But it also, when towns are strapped for cash, it's a difficult thing to deal with.
Also, too, you know, we have this storm and then we know it's going to be, you know, up close to 60 degrees in the next couple of days and rain. You're thinking, okay, that snow's going to be gone in a couple of days.
I'm counting on that. I didn't shovel this time for that
very
reason.
I didn't either. So, yeah, let's hope so. And let's hope this is the last snowstorm because I know Farmer's Almanac said we were going to get
mid-April?
One at the beginning of in April. And
please,
I'm hoping they're wrong on that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. All right. All right. So in other news, Cape police departments were pushing for access to a life-saving overdose drug, and they're going to get it because Governor Patrick has declared war on an opiate epidemic.
Declared war, which a number of advocates, State Rep Randy Hunt, police chiefs, definitely families that have been impacted on this have been, you know, calling for action everywhere they can get it. And so yesterday evening, the governor declared this public health emergency. And so it does three things: $20 million for drug abuse prevention, intervention, treatment and recovery programs, banning this controversial painkiller, Zohydro. It's this powerful opiate based painkiller that the FDA recently approved in opposition, really, to their own panel that looks at this stuff prior to them voting. And a lot of people said, why would you in the middle of an epidemic like this, when so many people are addicted to opiate-based drugs, why would you approve a drug like this? So the second thing that the governor's declaration does is ban that particular drug from being used. But also, it clears the way for something that the police have been calling for and the district attorney, which is to allow police officers to carry and administer this drug, popularly known as Narcan. It's like a nasal spray. And in many instances, within minutes, it can bring somebody back from an overdose. And when you think about it, it's literally saved thousands of lives. And so it makes a powerful case for police, who are often, you know, the first ones on the scene, to be able to administer this. You know, of course, there's been some concerns about liability, the Good Samaritan law that, you know, that basically makes it so that people that are in dire straits and get medical help can't, you know, sort of later sue, these kind of things. You know, some folks, you know, there are a small minority of folks who are sort of worried about the widespread use of Narcan, saying that it will sort of normalize drug use, like it will sort of put this idea in people's heads, like, eh, if I overdose, no big deal, you can just give me the Narcan. But it seems, you know, with the number of lives that have been saved, it seems like, you know, almost a slam dunk here. And so the governor yesterday decided to put this in place. And as I understand it, or as the paper was told, this emergency declaration stays in place for 90 days, I believe. I think it's a 90-day period. In April, there's supposed to be some public hearings where I think they're going to try to figure out, you know, what to do next. There were some other things involved with this. Like, for example, the declaration mandates that that physicians and pharmacies participate in this mandated prescription monitoring program. And then the governor also retasked the Interagency Council on Substance Abuse and Prevention to make some recommendations in the next few months about, you know, some of the things that need to be done. A lot of the things sounding like something that State Rep Randy Hunt out of Sandwich has been calling for, which is, you know, a lot more emphasis on treatment and prevention programs, and including looking at ways of possibly diverting nonviolent criminals into treatment programs.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big problem, and I think people are becoming a little more aware of it. But for a long time, this has been going on for a while. I mean, Casey Myers has been reporting on this for quite some time now. But I think it's taken some people by surprise just how bad the situation is, and it's not just the Cape; it's all over.
It's all over, you know. And then the deaths. I think the governor mentioned 140. I've seen a figure earlier of 185 overdose just since November. I think decades ago, I think this was sort of looked at as it being confined to a certain segment of society. Now it seems as if, you know, particularly because of the painkiller, because what happens is these painkillers, the police of in law enforcement has really cracked down on the availability on the street. And also that has made the cost of these pills go up. But when people are already addicted, then they end up saying, well, I'll go to the cheap, easy stuff, which is heroin.
Right.
And now, you know, we have these widespread addictions across all kinds of socioeconomic groups. And I think it's really, you know, wake a lot of people up to the severity of the problem.
Yeah. It's interesting about the governor banning that drug, which I can't remember what you called it.
Zohydro?
Yeah. So the FDA approves it. Which is, I guess, on the federal level, but states can ban that?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question. I'm not sure about that. This ban here from the governor makes Massachusetts the first state in the country to do that.
That's interesting.
So maybe in some ways we may be in sort of new territory. I don't know the particulars on that, but that is an interesting question to see if he gets any pushback from the FDA.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Cape Wind landed another financial backer this week.
This is Natixis and Rabobank. Basically, they're here's another vocabulary word for us: lead arrangers for the project. So a lead arranger are people that are responsible for organizing a group of commercial banks to provide the financing. So basically, this is sort of, you know, this is this slow inching forward. It's been picking up speed recently, but this is a key piece. The estimated cost to build the 130 wind turbines out in Nantucket Sound is $2.6 billion. That's the number that's been sort of floating out there. Some folks say it's probably higher now because, you know, time has gone on and prices go up. But this debt here that they've secured, these loans that they're securing, gets them right around the $1 billion mark, I think. So on paper, it looks like they may be sort of halfway to some of the financing. And, you know, we've been reporting, or Patrick Cassidy has been reporting all along, all of these various people, the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi, who's sort of leading this whole, the financial effort behind this. They're saying that there's a lot of interest from other commercial banks. The project also, in Patrick's story this week, pointed out how Cape Wind developer is looking, hopefully, to get a $500 million loan from the department, a little help from Uncle Sam, and also to qualify for some tax credits. So, and of course, we can't talk about this without mentioning that there is still strong opposition to this. There are still some legal challenges out there. And in some ways, it's sort of a race to the clock. Audra Parker from the Nantucket the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound points out that, you know, some of the contracts for them to get started will expire by the end of 2015. And so if they can't get this thing moving by then, that might create sort of another wrinkle in this decade-old project and debate.
Yeah, who would have thought it would, you know, a decade later we'd still be, you know, talking about that would take, you know, this long.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so while we're on the subject of turbines, Falmouth will receive up to $1.8 million to help offset money the town lost in reduced wind turbine operation.
This is from the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, they call it MassCEC, and the idea is, the state is basically recognizing, okay, so there was this court order in November after, of course, these wind turbines have been the subject of great complaints from a number of neighbors there who talk about the impacts that it's had on their health and so forth. And they've even brought some complaints to court. And in this November court order, it made Falmouth cut the turbines' operating hours from 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, to 12 hours a day and none on Sunday. So the town is saying that means that they're going to lose about $250,000, $280,000 annually of what they expected to be saving in terms of energy costs in the town. So there's a real cost to the reduced hours. And so this is MassCEC recognizing that. MassCEC is this organization that was sort of set up under the Green Energies Act within the state to get us closer to the goal of getting more of the state's energy needs met through renewable energy. So they have a real interest in not having the infrastructure to do that disintegrate. Mm-hmm. And so, but they're recognizing the financial hardship. This $1.8 million is something that they plan to pay, you know, over 15 years with, I think, a sort of a lump sum at the beginning of $500,000 that's contingent on a town meeting vote approving some money for, I can't remember exactly what it is, but they need to throw in some money themselves on this. And so, town manager Julian Sussell says he's guardedly optimistic that will pass. I'm not so sure about that.
I was going to say, this is kind of interesting because, you know, the court orders to reduce the hours that you're operating, and then they say, okay, so obviously the town's losing money. So this this group that's giving the money to the town, what happens if they have to reduce it more or it goes longer? Are they going to keep giving them more money?
And that's certainly what critics of these wind turbines, particularly around Blackshop Smith Road, would like to see. For these not to just be reduced in hours, but to be completely removed, to be down to zero. So, you know, I'm sure this isn't the end of it.
Yeah.
You know,
and
town meeting, of course, is coming up in the first week of April. So,
yeah. All right. 12 Cape Cod protesters who were arrested for trespassing at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station had their day in court. They were found guilty, but they say it wasn't about the verdict.
It wasn't about the verdict for Cape Downwinders. Diane Turco, in fact, we quote her in the story saying the verdict doesn't matter. The truth got out. It was interesting. I mean, this is the first time there's been a group of protesters. What they were doing was going to Entergy to deliver a letter to Entergy officials, which they didn't accept. They went on their private property there. They were arrested. It was, you know, civil disobedience, clearly. And in when they've tried this before, the cases have always been dismissed. So in talking with some of them actually leading up to this, they were actually sort of hoping that it wouldn't be dismissed so that they would get their day in court. And they did. It was a 4-day trial. And during the trial, you had an epidemiologist testify about elevated cancer rates in Plymouth and neighboring towns. You had an emergency management expert saying, hey, there's no evacuation plan should something happen for the Cape and Islands. There's an energy and security expert who talked about the dangers of storing all that spent fuel there on the plant property. And what was interesting, another vocabulary word, real good vocabulary week in the paper this week, the necessity defense. And that is basically when you have to, if you can prove that you're doing something where there's immediate danger, you're doing something to try to prevent immediate danger, that the action was effective in addressing or abating that danger, and that all other legal avenues had been exhausted, you can put forward this. I mean, they even brought Henry David Thoreau and Mahatma Gandhi into the trial, you know, in the context of civil disobedience. And so they were sentenced to a day in jail with time served.
Yeah, but they got their message out.
They got their message. Even State Senator Dan Wolf testified in this trial, saying that, you know, that the plant should be closed down, and that he deemed it an unacceptable risk.
And of course, this is another story that we'll be here for a while. We'll be talking about for some time to come. It's a news roundup. We're talking about the top stories of the week. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's the news roundup, where we discuss the top stories of the week. I'm Indy Todd, in for Sean Corcoran. With me in the Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. And joining us on the phone, Tim Woods, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Morning, Tim.
Good morning, Mindy.
So we mentioned at the top of the program the blizzard. One of the more dramatic photos of the damage comes from that house in Chatham where this historic house was being renovated and it collapsed. Sad story.
Yeah, that's right. For the owners of the house, certainly an unfortunate turn of events. As you said, the house was undergoing renovations and the interior had been gutted and the shingles were stripped. It was basically down to the beams and the wallboards. And it survived the night, but around 7 o'clock Wednesday morning, winds, they were gusting about 70 miles an hour down there by the lighthouse, which is where this house is located, right next to the lighthouse. The home just sort of leaned over to the south as the winds from the north pushed it and just collapsed it into a big heap. Now, this is kind of a backstory to this in that the house was the subject of protracted negotiations between the owners and the town's historic commission and even the Cape Cod Commission regarding renovation of this home, which is part of the Old Village Historic District. It was a very charming three-quarter cape, very unassuming, but nestled right out there at the corner. According to the architect, they had gotten past all the approvals, and they finally got down to the work. They had put in some lolly columns in the basement, so the whole first floor decking was secured, and they had braced the interior structure, knowing that the storm was coming. But obviously, it wasn't enough. They planned to salvage as much of the original structure, the beams and the wallboards, as they can, and incorporate those into the newly built structure. They have to rebuild it exactly the way it was. I was down there at the site yesterday. Crews were pulling out, a couple windows, and there were piles of beams on the lot stacked, and you could see they were stacked and marked, so they knew where the beams came from. As I said, they have to recreate exactly the way the building was originally. If they can't do that, the project's going to have to go back to the Historic Commission and the Cape Cod Commission.
It's really interesting that two centuries this house has survived hurricanes and other storms. But
for two centuries it was a full house with all its structure intact. Uh-huh. It had really been stripped down to almost nothing. You could look right through it. Uh-huh. I drove by there a couple days before the storm, and it caught my eye, and I said to myself, gee, I got to get back here and get a picture of that, and I should have done that right away. There was really not much left to the structure at the point that the storm hit, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. All right, and the Chatham Board of Selectmen backing a limit on the expansion of the floodplain FEMA maps?
That's true. We've talked a lot about the FEMA maps lately. It's a topic of a lot of concern here in Chatham. As you know, the new floodplain maps not only increase insurance rates, they're also going to increase the extent of the flood zone. And many homeowners say it's going to bring it within areas that aren't even subject to flooding or wetlands concerns. In Chatham, we have a 100-foot buffer zone that extends beyond what the floodplain is, and that's what this particular issue is. The concern in town is that that 100-foot buffer is going to extend way beyond any legitimate wetland issues or resources. And this week, the Chatham Selectmen endorsed a petition article for town meeting, which will limit the Conservation Commission's jurisdiction by removing that 100-foot buffer area for properties subject to coastal flooding. In other words, from the coastal from those FEMA maps. Now, this article is going to have to be reconciled with two others that are going to be on the warrant related to the flood maps. One is sponsored by the Planning Board, which retains that 100-foot buffer from the flood zone, but keeps it at the current levels and doesn't expand it under the new floodplain where it would expand under the new floodplain maps. And there's still another petition article which would expand the Conservation Commission's jurisdiction based on that 100-foot buffer zone to cover the new areas incorporated into the new FEMA flood maps. Selectmen have not addressed those other two articles yet. But they're going to have a lot of explaining to do, I think, on the floor of town meeting.
This is a complicated issue, understanding these new maps.
It's very complicated. Unless you have a home in the flood zone, you can tend to not care about it. But there's a lot of homes that are going to be within that 100-foot buffer zone from the flood zone once these new maps are approved.
Yeah, and the prices, I mean, the cost of this insurance is just, it's not like it's going up a little bit for some of these people. I mean, it's thousands and thousands of dollars.
Sure, and there's no choice in getting the insurance because if you ever want to sell your house, right, you don't have the insurance, you can't get a mortgage.
Right, it's crazy. Well, after 143 years, this is going to be the last for Chatham High School, the last graduating class at Chatham High.
Yeah, last graduating class. That's right. After in June, Chatham High School will cease to exist as a separate entity. The physical school is going to remain in place. It's going to become part of. It's going to become the new Monomoy Regional Middle School. But the high school grades are being absorbed into the new Monomoy Regional High School. To commemorate this event, the organizers at the high school are planning a day-long open house with a cookout and a softball game. It's going to be held June 20th, and they're inviting past students and teachers and community members to come to the Coral Road School that day. You can sit in on classes in the morning if you want, see your old teachers. Old teachers, you know, former teachers can come back and visit their old classrooms. There's going to be a free cookout in the afternoon and then a faculty-student softball game with both alumni and current teachers and students. There's also going to be a slideshow running in the auditorium all day. They're soliciting photographs right now to put that together. If anybody has any, the address to send that in is on our website and in the paper this week. Chatham's a town that's really built on tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been proud to have its own high school, even in the days years ago when the classes were a dozen students, and even in recent years, there's been, you know, a couple dozen students in some of the classes. So the loss of the high school identity, I think, for many longtime residents and especially teachers and alumni, it's kind of bittersweet. And so there's you know, the celebration is going to be held to kind of mark that, and hopefully everybody will be able to move on to the new Monomoy district.
Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow Tim and the Chronicle on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Tim, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mindy. Take care.
Yep, bye-bye. Joshua Balling now joins us on the phone. He's the assistant editor at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Morning, Josh.
Morning.
All right, so you guys got the brunt of the storm this time. Usually it's the other way around.
Really got walloped by this storm. Really fierce coastal nor'easter came right near the island, right over the island, brought with it winds that at one place at least topped 98 miles an hour,
wow,
and other places over 80 miles an hour. We were cut off from the mainland essentially for as far as travel goes. All boat and plane service was canceled for the whole day. Schools obviously were closed. Many businesses, offices, the courts, the town building, everything closed. Most people stayed inside, hunkered down, and tried to wait it out. 10.5 inches of snow on the ground, although there's probably only about 3 or 4 left now with the weather warming up a little bit, but it was a real storm. I'll give it that.
It was wild, and a lot of people lost electricity. So not only were you cut off, you were also in the dark.
Yeah, about 1,300 homes lost electricity, mostly on the east end of the island in Pulpis, Sconset, Wawinet. A number of people out there went to the Sconset Fire Station to warm up for a couple of hours. There was a warming station at the high school that was set up. Nobody ended up using it. The roads from Sconset into town were actually drifted over. Nobody could get in, so they opened up the Wisconsin Fire Station to warm some people up. A few people were also escorted into town by the police and fire departments to check into some of the downtown hotels when they still didn't have power on Wednesday night. But all in all, the majority of the island had power, had heat. Most people, again, stayed in. A few people were out and about. Plows did the best they could to keep the roads open, but there were some drifts upwards of 6-7 feet on the main roads going out to the east end of the island that it took several hours to clear off.
Yeah, it isn't often you can break out the cross-country skis on Nantucket, but I guess this was one of the few.
It certainly was, if you were willing to brave the 90-mile-an-hour
wind. I meant after, yeah.
After back, we did get some pictures we have on our website in one of our reader galleries of a couple of hardy souls snowboarding, too. So not too many chances you get to do some downhilling.
That's right.
They could on Wednesday.
All right, so another story this week. Restrictions on the ivory trade are impacting some island artisans?
They are. The skirmishanders and lightship basket makers in particular. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back in February issued a director's order prohibiting the commercial import of elephant ivory. And those rules also apply to rhino horn, whale teeth, which is of particular importance out here on Nantucket, as lightship basket making and a lot of the skirmishanding happened on Nantucket whale ships in the 1700s and 1800s. Walrus tusks, tortoise shell, and some woods that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. These regulations are supposed to go into effect in June, and they really restrict the amount and kind of ivory and other materials that can be imported, as well as the sale of objects using these materials. And that would obviously impact the lightship basket makers, carvers. No interstate commerce, no import or export, except for some very, very specific ways. Out here, basket makers say it could very well destroy Nantucket's lightship basket industry, which is a small cottage industry, but Nantucket is known for making some of the best and highest quality lightship baskets in the world, and they're usually adorned with plates on the top that are made from whalebone or from ivory, very intricately detailed and etched, and really sort of set off the lightship baskets, and that could change if it gets that much more difficult to import and also to sell across state lines, these lightship baskets and other carvings.
Is there some other kind of maybe synthetic material that they could use?
They certainly could use some kind of synthetic material or simply use wood, but it just wouldn't be the same, they say. They say that, you know, we're artisans who have worked in these materials for generations, and, you know, they currently work with antique ivory. There's been regulations in place since the 80s that allow for the use and sale of antique ivory. They can prove that it's over 100 years old. There are, you know, vast storehouses of what is believed to be antique ivory from around the world. Sometimes it's proven actually that it's not, and some people end up being prosecuted for it. But there is still a lot of it out there, and that's what Nantucket's carvers at least say they're largely working in. And it's been working fine. They are not involving any endangered species, and they really just sort of wonder why the ban has gotten so strict now when it's been working well for the last 30 or 40 years.
Right. And then it'll be lights, camera, action beginning next week as filming gets underway in a major motion picture. I guess you had a lot of Nantucketers who were extras in this film?
Extras and have some speaking parts as well.
Ah.
Independent filmmaker Jay Craven from Vermont, also a longtime Nantucket visitor, and he's been out here working on his own and with the Nantucket Film Festival on occasion with the Athenaeum Library as well, is going to be filming a major motion picture called Peter and John, based on a de Maupassant book of the same name, and they're supposed to start filming next week. Some major stars in that, including Jacqueline Bisset and you know, a lot of Nantucketers as well, who are going to either have speaking parts or be extras. So don't be surprised to see cameras and hearing lights, camera, action downtown Nantucket over the next few weeks.
Yeah. When will that film be shown? Like a year or something?
Yeah, probably about that. If it follows the track of most major motion pictures, at least you know, a few months of filming and production, and then you know, it could be upwards of a year or two in the editing suite. And you know, again, there's financing thing and all kinds of other you know, factors that play into it, especially when you're talking about independent films. So hopefully within a year or two, you'll see you know, Peter and John on the screen.
Right. Joshua Balling, assistant editor at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as director of digital content. You can follow Josh on Twitter at jballingim. Josh, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. All right, Sean, as plans come together for casinos in our region, there's been some concerns about the entertainment they draw and venues like the Melody Tent being shut out of booking some of these same performers. But it seems an agreement's been reached to prevent that.
Yeah, I thought Ethan Genter's story in our paper this week was interesting because it kind of gives you a look behind the wizard's curtain. You know, because, you know, down here, you know, there's been times where I've wondered, how come the Melody Tent or whatever, certain venues don't get certain acts? And And this kind of sheds a little bit of light on it. So what happened this week is you have these seven members, which includes the Cape Cod Melody Tent group there that is also affiliated with South Shore Music Circus. They're part of this Massachusetts Performing Arts Coalition. And so because Mohegan Sun is looking to build this $1.3 billion resort casino at Suffolk Downs in Revere, there's something that there's a provision in the State Gaming Act that sort of prods them to get together on this. And so what it allows for is for places like Mohegan Sun, or Mohegan Sun in this case, to not be able to shut out the booking of a performer who's played at that venue. Because I guess what happens sometimes is, you know, a Mohegan Sun will sign an act and say, and oh, by the way, you can't perform at any of any other competing
exclusive
venues. And it's exclusive. And so this lightens that up a bit. And the Massachusetts Performing Arts Coalition Chairman, Tony Siebels, he's calling it a win-win because in many ways, there isn't really direct competition in the sense that Mohegan Sun is able to land the big acts, you know, the Bruce Springsteens mm-hmm. of the world, whereas a lot of these venues like the Cape Cod Melody Tent, they're looking for what, you know, you would consider mid-size acts. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying this as a boon to maybe seeing more comedians, particularly, you know, like even of the likes of Jerry Seinfeld and Dennis Leary. Also, you know, more sort of popular comedians, up-and-coming country acts, but mostly mid-size acts that are playing to crowds of 1,000 to 3,500 people, not like these stadium acts that in a lot of instances these big resorts can afford to bring in. So I thought it was interesting, as I said, because it gives you kind of a peek behind some of the maneuvering that goes on in booking, booking acts.
Yeah. And another story this week, interesting study released on the travels of the leatherback turtles. You know, you envision them all going, you know, south, but a lot of them just sort of stay in the area.
Yeah, I thought Doug Fraser's story on leatherbacks was a fascinating story for a whole bunch of reasons. Well, you know, it was interesting. Scott Landry at the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies said that they're almost like ghosts. And what he's talking about is this study out of the University of New Hampshire that's tracked 20 of these huge turtles using these specialized satellite tags. And they found that basically, all of them stayed in waters just off the Cape for the whole summer. They're out there munching on jellyfish and so forth. The problem is, or the concern, I should say, is that they're in these coastal areas and shallow water, which means that there's a higher risk for them to ingest all of this plastic that's mm-hmm. out there floating, also to be getting entangled. And for the past couple of years, it's been a rough couple of years for these leatherbacks around here. There were 37 that had to be disentangled in 2012, 52 last summer. So, what I found interesting is, aside from the concerns and everything, there were a lot of cool facts, I thought, about these things. Number one, that, first of all, we all knew that they were huge. You know, Doug, I think, called them the marine equivalent of a Volkswagen Beetle. They weigh about 2,000 pounds. They can get up to 8 feet. But what I thought was fascinating is I didn't know the guy leatherbacks, they never come out of the water. Only the females do when they come on to lay their eggs. And so I thought that was fascinating. I thought it was also fascinating that very rarely do they come up to the surface. And that's the reason why Scott Landry at the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies said that they were, you know, like ghosts almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because this tells us a lot of where they are, and, you know, getting hit by ships, of course, is a big concern. They move, they're huge, and they move really slowly. It's not like they can get out of the way.
That's right. That's right. So that now the real concern here now moving forward, well, first of all, what they hope is that the data in the study are going to help fishermen, boaters, everybody get a better understanding of where they hang out, where they're eating, you know, where they like to dine on jellyfish, to try to reduce some of that. And then, you know, whether it's entanglements or being struck by boats. The problem moving forward is there's no money for research out there right now. There's a lot of, you know, research funds that are being scaled back because a lot of this research is funded, you know, through government grants and so forth. A lot of that stuff has been scaled back. So the real scramble next is to figure out, where are we going to get money to further our understanding? Because there's really not a whole, you know, depth of understanding about these, you know, fascinating creatures.
No. It's a news roundup. We're talking about the top stories of the week. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's the News Roundup, and I'm Mindy Todd sitting in for Sean Corcoran. Joining me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsovs, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Well, Sean, again, questions being raised about the Falmouth High School renovation.
Yes, and it's a question that's going to come up at the April 7th town meeting there. There's a Falmouth resident named Margot Finnell, and she's really been trying to she's not the only one who have been aggravated with this renovation project, which really turned into a nightmare for the town in many ways, you know, going back over several years. And so the article that she has got on the town warrant by petition, a petition drive, asked for $25,000 to do a review of the project. Now, similar articles, you know, on this issue were brought forward in 2008, in 2012, that didn't have funding attached to them. So she's hoping that with this specific dollar figure that this will pass muster at town meeting. Just to remind people the background, the high school renovation project was, you know, was supposed to only go on for 2 years, and it was supposed to cost $67 million. But it ended up taking it was 3 years late by the time it was done, and it went $19 million over budget. And so, you know, in 2008, the town meeting had recommended that the Board of Selectmen, you know, quote, exercise its authority to conduct an investigation of this renovation project. But that, you know, that particular issue, again, it didn't have the money figure attached to it. So that ended up being shelved. Then they tried to do it again in the spring of 2012, a few years ago, asking for them to appropriate an unnamed sum of money to get to the bottom of this. That was also rejected. And really what it comes down to is the Board of Selectmen, it's been a rough issue for them, number one. And also they're saying, look, it's built, the money is spent, let's let sleeping dogs lie. You know, let's move on here. We've gone to court over this issue. The beef with the contractors and the subcontractors has been well documented. In fact, they ended up they fired one of the contractors in the middle of the project, which led to the town being sued. And then the town ended up having to pay them some money for breach of contract. Most recently, the Board of Selectmen actually voted 4-1 that they're going to recommend that town meeting indefinitely postpone this particular article. Selectman Doug Jones, you know, he says that, and we have him quoted in Sean Driscoll's story, saying that we've been down this road to put more money towards it. It doesn't, you know, he doesn't understand what they're going to get out of this. And, you know, Margot Finnell is saying, I'm not asking for an audit. It's not a witch hunt, but we need to, with some big ticket items coming down the road, wastewater treatment issues. She thinks that what led to this was decisions that were made. She wants there to be an accounting for an awareness so that as they move forward on other big money projects, they don't run into the same kind of problems again. It's just, you know, to me, and I think to the selectmen, it's just not clear what precisely it is that they're supposed to do to figure that part of it out.
And so it's about process, really.
So it's really about process. And in April 7th, Falmouth, by the way, is a representative town meeting. So it's not as if, you know, it's not an open town meeting where everybody in town gets to come. There's elected representatives that are on that represent town residents at town meeting. So if it passes muster with them, it's not exactly clear, you know, how the town will move forward. But at this point, Margot Finnell is hoping to get some questions answered and hopes that this article, if it passes, will move towards that.
Right. Well, the World Oyster Society could be hosting their annual symposium on the Cape next year.
That's right, because it's like a gold rush here if you're in this business. It's really the epicenter of the Massachusetts oyster growing industry. In 2010, fishermen and aquaculturists landed 2.9 million pounds of oysters that were worth about $7 million. In 2012, it was 4 million pounds, which is worth about $11.6 million. So eureka, you know, I mean, it's and so in 2015, the big news is that the Cape region is going to be was chosen as the host for this international, the sixth international oyster symposium, which was held in Vietnam last year. So, you know, Wendy Northcross is in the story just really saying it's really great for us for obvious reasons. I mean, 3,000 people went to the one in Vietnam. It brought people from all over the world. So whenever you're bringing that many people to the Cape, it's good for the Cape's economy. And so that's one cause for celebration.
Oyster business.
It's good for our oyster business. And it's also good for people like me who absolutely love oysters. So there will be Oyster Week that will be in October. That will be bookend. You got the Wellfleet Oyster Fest that will kick things off. There'll be the symposium that they think will probably happen on the Upper Cape because there's a lot of tie-in with the marine science community around here, HUI and MBL. So there's still some details to work out as they move forward in planning, but it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think so, too. All right, joining us on the phone, Nelson Siegelman, editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning, Mindy.
Do I hear a congratulations is in order? You are now editor?
That's what I've been told. I read it with you.
All right, so you have some. Tell us what's going on with this Edgartown Library project.
Well, Martha's Vineyard is awash in library projects, it would seem. They celebrated the opening of the new West Tisbury Library just last week, and then on Monday, the Edgartown Selectmen and library officials broke ground for a new library. It's going to be a more than $7 million project. It's going to be set next to the Edgartown School, and they're all very excited about it because I'm sure, as your readers know and listeners, the libraries are becoming more than just a repository now of books. They're really community centers. So in conjunction with that, there has been a long-running battle between the Edgartown Library Foundation and library trustees over some of the plans for this new library. The end result was that the foundation was holding on to some donation money, more than $450,000, but it seems that there's been a thaw in the feud now, and the foundation recently donated $110,000 to the new library project. So we're following that, and that I'm sure town officials hope that more money will be coming forward in the future.
And was there was some controversy over holding the money and then releasing some of it, and what happens to the rest of it?
The controversy has been going on now for a number of years. It had to do with some naming rights. It had to do with the original location of the library and the original plans, which they had wanted to build on the current site of the library, which is a charming building right in downtown Edgartown, but ultimately the cost and the location and just the facilities that they needed weren't going to work in that location. So, you know, like many things in a small town, they get hot for a while, and then eventually people start to work things out. You see these people on the street, you can't stay mad forever. or some people can on the island, but hopefully this will all work out, and this donation is a good indication of that.
And you also have a story this week about an abundance of roadside trash.
Yes, again, this gets to the heart of local reporting, I think. I was driving along the road and saw all of this trash and suggested to one of our young interns that he'd do a story on it. And what he did is he just started at one end and walked and drove along the road, noting all of the bits of trash. And really what it comes from is we have a transfer station near the airport, so that when people are bringing trash to the transfer station, oftentimes if they have pickup trucks, the trash, if it's not well secured, will blow out. And we think that's what happens. There is a rule when people arrive at the transfer station that all loads have to be covered and secured, but not everybody follows that. And the local House of Correction will periodically supply work crews to pick up trash, and the State Highway Department, which is responsible for that section of the road, also does their share. But it was looking pretty trashy last week, and that was a combination of many things, mostly the weather. So we thought it was a good time to highlight that and also remind people to keep their trash covered so it doesn't blow out of their truck.
Yeah, so we see that everywhere. We see that, you know, as people are driving, that the little things flying all over. And partly, too, we've, you know, had a bit of snow this year, too, so it's kind of covering it up. So sometimes where we might see some people picking up the trash, we haven't seen it as much this winter. Could that be part of it? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I think the weather is. And you know, we all appreciate where we live, certainly on the Cape and Islands. We appreciate the natural beauty. So it's a little, trash sort of, I think, stands out more when you're driving along than it might in other parts of the country or in the city where that seems to get overlooked. So it's, we all have to do our part, but certainly we can cover our loads and we'll go into the transfer station.
Exactly. Nelson Siegelman, editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks so much, Nelson, for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Sean, sad story this week. Leo Finn lost his battle with cancer.
Leo Finn did succumb to cancer. He was 48 years old. And to remind our listeners, Leo Finn was really gained notoriety, so to speak, during the government shutdown. People will recall that mess that happened there with Congress and not being able to pass the budget bill and so forth. And Leo Finn, though, was caught up in the machinations of that. He was trying to beat this rare form of bile duct cancer and was wanting to try this experimental drug through this clinical trial with the National Institutes of Health. But the government shutdown happened before the National Institutes of Health gave permission to move forward with it. And then the workers there, of course, were sent home, and it stopped everything. Well, he spoke out. People rallied around behind him. Congressman Bill Keating got involved and, in fact, was the one who announced that, you know, some deal was made to essentially reclassify, I think, certain National Institute of Health workers as essential employees. And so, and this wasn't just for Finn. It ungummed the works for any of the tests that had been halted throughout the country. So it reclassified some of those workers as essential workers, and therefore they were able to come back to work. Unfortunately, the experimental drugs didn't help. He did succumb, and it was a loss to the community. I mean, this is somebody, as our story pointed out, that was really loved by everybody who met him. His Facebook page was loaded with comments and pictures. And I don't know if listeners will recall, I mean, the community really rallied around him. There was the, in June last summer, they had the fundraising event called Lift for Leo at Buzzards Bay Park. There were people across the Cape that were wearing these T-shirts that said Finn to Win, Knockout Cancer. There were actually bracelets that said that. So there was just a lot of support behind him and a lot of people really rooting for him. So it's just sad to know that, you know, that he passed on this past Sunday.
Yeah. Only 48 years old.
Only 48. Yeah. The funeral arrangements haven't been yet finalized, but I'm sure there'll be quite a few people there to mourn his death.
Well, the principal of West Villages Elementary School in Marston's Mills certainly got creative in his efforts to get the students to read more.
He sure did. It's nice to see a principal this excited about reading. So there were these three challenges for the students throughout the years to get them to read thousands of pages, really, when you add it all up. And so the first mark was the 75,000 mark, which the kid, or actually 73,000 might have been the mark. They surpassed that to 75,000. So what he did is he agreed to kiss a pig. It was a 2-week-old piglet from Miss Scarlett's Blue Ribbon Farm in Yarmouthport, and he kissed the pig without any lipstick, actually. So that was pretty cool, and not only that, but because it was for the whole school, they had to break it into two assemblies. So
he had to
go back for seconds, right? Yeah. So he kissed the pig twice. And because they read so much and hit marks throughout the year, he had also agreed to have his head shaved, which was also done in two parts. Part of it was shaved by the superintendent. Another part was shaved by a parent. And then he also agreed to do a polar plunge. And he did that. He did a backwards leap into Chapin Memorial Beach. The kids weren't actually at the beach, but it was videotaped and showed on YouTube. So, I mean, you want to talk about sacrificing yourself to motivate the students. This is it.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, look what all these kids, I mean, they went above and beyond what he expected, and hopefully now they're hooked on reading.
Right. I mean, of course, reading is still fundamental. And if anybody wants to see video, by the way, I should mention Cape Cod Online, the Cape Cast guys.
Oh, they got it.
Have a video of him at least kissing the pig.
All right.
So if you want to see that site, go check it out.
All right. Red Sox opening day.
Red Sox opening day is coming up. Opening day is on March 31st. I actually, now that I'm thinking of it, I don't remember if the Red Sox, I don't know that they open in Fenway, but wherever they open, it will be welcome. I can almost smell the hot dogs and the roasted peanuts now.
And
with
the warmer
this weather,
temperatures.
You know, it's just a warm thought to think of baseball. And also, you know, we're not far away. Oh, they're playing Baltimore.
There you go.
They're playing Baltimore Orioles. And this should be a competitive division, be a good season. And then with opening day in baseball, that means it's not that much longer before Cape Cod Baseball League opening
day,
which is June 11th.
Woo-hoo.
So, you know, I'm starting to feel warm already.
All right. Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Thanks for being here. Also, thanks to Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling, Nantucket's Inquirer and Mirror, and Nelson Siegelman at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for listening. I'm Indy Todd.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.